Hour. From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a long campaign, in a disputed election, in a more innocent time, George W. Bush was casually derided by many as a fool. He seemed destined to survive, not to redefine the U.S. presidency. Then came 9/11, the terrorist attacks sobered the nation and gave President Bush a chance to be remembered as a leader, not a bumbler. In his new book, Ambling into History, Frank Bruni, who covered the presidential campaign for the New York Times, writes about the unlikely journey of candidate Bush to the White House, from frat boy rascal to commander and comforter in chief. Even now, the intimate moments on the campaign trail speak volumes about the sort of leader Bush would be, foreshadowing his weaknesses and his unforeseen strengths. Who is George W. Bush, and how are his character and personal history now defining the nation in a time of challenge with no clear precedent? We're taking the measure of the man, what he calls up from the American nation, what imprint he will leave. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from Washington is Frank Bruni. He writes for the New York Times Sunday Magazine and is author of Ambling into History, The Unlikely Odyssey of George W. Bush. Good evening and welcome, Frank Bruni.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening and welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Frank Bruni, take us back. You were on the bus, as they say, with George Bush through a great portion of his campaign for the presidency. Tell us the truth. At that time, did you think that you were seeing a solid future president of the United States in action, or did you have some reservations?
Well, I knew I might be seeing a future president in action because the polls told us that from a very early point. I mean, when I hooked up with him, or with his campaign, I should say, in August of 1999, amazingly, even though he had only recently been reelected to a second term as Texas governor and was someone who had not held elective office before becoming Texas governor, he had these amazing poll numbers where in hypothetical head-to-head matchups against Al Gore, for instance, he was the winner, and he was way ahead of the Republican field. So I knew I might be seeing and watching a future president. As far as what he would bring to that job, you know, that was a little less clear to me. I mean, it took a while to really understand who he was, what he was about. There was a lot of very silly behavior on his part that didn't seem to jibe completely with the office he was seeking and the kind of gravitas he would need to inhabit it. So, yeah, there were certainly questions about that.
You write, "The Bush I knew was part scamp and part bumbler, a timeless fraternity boy and heedless cut-up, a weekday gym rat and weekend napster, an adult with an inner child that often brimmed to the surface or burst through." And still, as you say, the poll numbers were great, and though it was a historic squeaker, this is the man that won. What do you think was resonating in the American electorate that was produced by this scamp, this bumbler, this frat boy that you describe?
Well, it's a good question because I certainly wrote about those dimensions of him at the time, and I think those dimensions did come across, you know, in TV coverage of him. So I think voters had a sense of how lighthearted he could be. I think what we need to remember is before September 11th, if you go back to the campaign, for many Americans, there weren't urgent issues involved in that campaign, nor for many Americans were there important and stark differences, at least to them, between George W. Bush and Al Gore. So, as I say elsewhere in the book, I mean, he was in some senses an easy, unthreatening man for what then seemed, an easygoing, unthreatening man for what then seemed easygoing, unthreatening times. I think a lot of the behavior that we're talking about made him, to many people, feel more like a real person, an authentic person, even if not the most, heavy or dignified person. And Al Gore, as we all know, had troubles breaking through to people in terms of making them feel warm about him, making himself feel real to them. So in some senses, this side of George W. Bush worked to his advantage.
Frank, take us back onto the airplanes, onto the buses. What were some of the moments, what are some of the moments that stick with you as defining that kind of frat boy side that was, you say, it was always waiting to bubble to the surface as soon
sure.
as the camera turned and sometimes before. What were some of the moments
sure.
that stick with you?
Oh, I mean, there's so many of them. I remember once jokingly when he was talking to us in the plane and he wanted to indicate that something was off the record, he literally reached over with his arms and stuck his index fingers deep into my ears. There was another moment, perhaps even a better one, when he was giving me an interview about his wife, Laura, and it was on the plane and it was almost mealtime and the flight attendants came around with the little hot, moist towels. And after wiping his hands with the towel, he unfurled it, stretched it over his fence and lunged quickly and turned toward me as if like he was a kid playing peekaboo.
You said over his fence, but I think you mean face. He was actually
over his face. Did I say fence?
So this was the president to be with a wet towel over his face, lunging at you on the airplane.
Exactly. Yeah, playing essentially a toddler's game of peekaboo.
Could it be that through these kind of hijinks, were these just guileless hijinks, or could it be that he was actually creating a kind of impression of harmlessness or good camaraderie with the press that would explicitly or implicitly filter through the stories that you wrote and others to signal to the American public, hey, this is not someone to be scared of. This is a good guy.
I don't think it was that cunning because, of course, there's another way that it plays as well. You know, when I wrote in the paper, as I did at the time, about that napkin, about the moist hot towel incident, you know, there were many readers who emailed me and said, you know, I am just embarrassed that this man is running for president. I'm embarrassed at him. I'm embarrassed for him. So I don't think it was gamed out that extensively. Mm-hmm. I think the only way in which I think it was strategic, and that's really not the right word for it, is George W. Bush is a man who prefers the jocular to the heavy, who tries to lighten up a lot of the circumstances he's in because that's how he feels most comfortable. So I think in some ways he was keeping himself amused and diverted as he went through a process that he found, and it was visible all along the way, quite grinding, quite grueling, and not always suited to the kind of person he was. I mean, this is a guy who was a homebody who really didn't like to travel much, and he hitches himself to a presidential campaign, you know? So a lot of it was just him trying to entertain himself, trying to keep the atmosphere light, but I don't know that it was as extensively gamed out as trying to appear harmless. Because for a lot of people, the main reaction to that kind of behavior was not, oh, gee, he's a harmless person, but, oh, gee, what's there, you know?
What's the effect? You point out, you say that by the afternoon of the very day that you met George W. Bush, he was calling you Frankie Boy and giving you a nickname like he loves to do. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the impact of George W. Bush's jocularity, his kind of frat boy humor and backslapping on the people around him, not only reporters, I guess, but the people that he works with, the people he needs to cajole onto his side politically in policy discussions?
You know, it depends on the person and the person's sensibility. For some people, I think it puts them at ease and it makes them feel, you know, remember when you're meeting someone who's, say, the governor of Texas or in this case, the president of the United States, it's very easy for a lot of people. And I'm not speaking of reporters here, but many other people, you know, voters, political colleagues or enemies, it's very easy for them to feel a little bit intimidated or like they have to stand on ceremony. So for some people, I think it put them at ease and said to them, this is not a guy who is overly full of himself or conducts himself with a lot of pretension, and they like it. For other people, it seems inappropriate and, you know, it has the opposite effect. It doesn't stiffen them up, but it makes them wonder if they're dealing with someone who's truly serious. So it's all in the beholder.
Jack Beatty, Frank Bruni puts it right in the title. He's writing about George W. Bush ambling into history with all the kind of casual nonchalance that implies. But of course, the Times did not stay casual or nonchalant.
No, they didn't. And it's hard for me to imagine that George W. Bush would have been elected if September 11th, if we lived in the world of September 11th, 2001 and September 2000. As Mr. Bruni says, it was there was a feeling that you could take a chance in that election. And the very lightness of being of this man and his almost willful lightness, I think would have been a serious handicap. Whereas if you look at a John McCain, you see someone hewn to the dimensions of a kind of warfare state. What strikes me about Mr. Bruni's book, which is very enjoyable, is the way he really played you guys like a drum. I mean, part of it, what Tom said, how he would come back and schmooze with you and thereby kind of defang or at least get some of the venom out of coverage. But also how he just sort of figured it out, that television is what elects our president and the presidents, and that television is all about mindless repetition. People turn it on, they see the same ad, they see the same ad, they see the same. And the president, as a candidate, perfected that. He said the same thing and said it again and said it again. And he's governing in the same way. He's kind of got it, hasn't he, Frank?
Got it.
The formula, the TV age formula for success. Get a line and
sure,
repeat it with a smile.
Sure. The problem is, I mean, I probably wrote 3, 4, 5, 6 stories about how he repeated himself ad nauseum. I remember doing one story where I went back and looked at the speeches he was giving as governor of Texas as far back as like 1996, and some of the same entire whole paragraphs that he was using in his presidential stump speech, which became what he used in his debates, which became the sound bites he gave in interviews. It was all the same. You know, the problem is, if you're doing TV, as you just noted, if you're doing TV, there's no way for a kind of correspondent to interrupt and say, this is what you say all the time, why are you just repeating yourself? And if you're doing print, you know, you can write a few times that this is a guy who's extremely wedded to pre-digested, predetermined sound bites that he repeats over and over. You can only say that so many times. And beyond that, you have to kind of leave it to voters to listen hard enough to figure out whether they're hearing something fresh or whether they're hearing something rehearsed. I think there's an obligation, in a sense, that voters and Americans have, and part of the problem is their disengagement from the process doesn't allow them to see some of those things or even hear some of those things when we point them out to them.
Frank Bruni, what about Jack Beatty's sense that if the world had been a sterner place at the time of the 2000 elections, the country might not or would not have been willing to take a chance, as Jack says, on George W. Bush? You watched him and you watched the poll numbers. You watched the crowds respond to him across the country. Do you think that Americans might have followed George W. even if the times had been tougher against Al Gore? Or I guess if it had been earlier, might they have turned to a Frank McCain? It's all hypothetical, but it says something about how his character meets the American electorate.
You know, it's hard to know, but I think Jack may well be right. I think it would have been a different election if the issues had seemed as grave as they do now, and that might well have favored Gore. Because people did, if you went, those very same polls where Bush was doing better than Gore, at least up until the end, and then it tightened, in those very same polls, people did indicate some concern about George W. Bush's level of international experience. They were clearly not putting that at the top, you know, as they did their issue triage of their priority list, and they might well have if we had had September 11th happen, say, you know, in October 2000. But it's hard because then there are other things like would George W. Bush have tried to and been able to cut a much different figure on the campaign trail? You know, each candidate would have made a whole host of adjustments because of that context. So it's so, you know, as you say, it's hypothetical. It's really hard to know. But I think it's a very interesting point.
Of course, the president did have to make major adjustments in real time, in the real presidency after 9/11. What would you have expected about the way George W. has responded to 9/11, and what has surprised you, Frank Bruni?
What initially surprised me, simply because it was a skill he didn't possess, and it was something he came to you know, so awkwardly in the past, was the eloquence, for lack of a better word, although eloquence is the wrong word with Bush because he's not a formal guy. It's not formal eloquence. But he had some moments in those days after September 11th when he stood much taller in the national spotlight, to my eyes, than he had before. Some moments where he said the very, very much the right things, like that meeting with rescue workers at Ground Zero.
Even unscripted moments, you're saying?
Unscripted. And then, I mean, I remember really being blown away in a sense, not because it was so amazing, but given his past performances, I remember being quite astonished by how well he delivered the September 20th address to Congress. I was also surprised, you know, in a substantive policy sense, when he began talking about what would need to happen in Afghanistan after the initial military actions, and essentially was edging up to and flirting with the whole idea of nation building that he had debunked or tried to debunk so thoroughly way back in a presidential debate with Al Gore. So that surprised me as well.
So a kind of flexibility there. And Jack Beatty, of course, now a chance to put an imprint on America that only big moments in history offer.
That's true. He has been presidentialized by September 11th.
We're talking about George W. Bush, taking an intimate look through Frank Bruni's book, Ambling into History, at the casual man who became president. Is this casual president turning out to be right for the country, for you? Do you remember Bush on the campaign trail? What struck you then, and how's it playing out now? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times correspondent Frank Bruni. He's just come out with a new book called Ambling into History, an intimate portrait of George W. Bush campaigning and then coming into the American presidency. Maybe he was elected on a lark in good times, but times have grown a lot more complicated. Is this casual president turning out to be right for the country, right for you? Where are this president's instincts taking the country now? How is this amiable president intersecting with history? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Frank Bruni, it's not all hijinks and nicknames and jokes with the lads and lasses on the campaign bus. There are ideological instincts and positions that also define this man. How would you define those?
Well, he's a pretty conservative guy. I think he's more conservative than his father was, certainly. And he has always, in the positions he's taken, abided by the kind of political dictum of shoring up your base first and then trying to woo moderates later. And we've seen that time and again, both in what he was recommending on the campaign trail, very heavy on tax cuts. You know, then he gets into office and it's where he puts his muscle in passing a tax cut, enacting a tax cut that was very much for economic conservatives in the party. He has tried to maintain smooth relations with religious conservatives. We've seen that. In other ways, he's a little bit more of a hodgepodge. I mean, he will yield in some instances. He dropped his demand for vouchers when it came to education reform. He surprised a lot of people with his decision on steel imports, which seemed to fly directly in the face of everything he'd said before them, but seemed politically expedient. So I'd say he's a pretty conservative to very conservative guy who, for reasons of political expediency, will occasionally budge significantly.
Yeah, if I may, I want to speak to that point.
Jack Beatty.
You know, it's so easy to criticize the media. I'm part of it, too. But, you know, I think the media sort of accepted or didn't sufficiently challenge the sort of premises of the Bush campaign. And one of the premises was, I'm not really that conservative. I'm a compassionate conservative. And a second premise was, between Gore and me, there really isn't much difference on the issues. We both favor the same things. Let me give an example. On the compassionate side, I remember doing a piece about this and looking into his Texas record. He vetoed a minimum wage increase for Texas farm laborers 7 times while he was governor. I don't know what definition of compassion could possibly accommodate that reality, and yet we didn't hear much about that. And on the issue of Gore and I really want the same things, the press handed this to him. Here's Jim Lehrer at a debate. He says, as a practical matter, both of you want to bring prescription drugs to seniors, correct? And then he said later on, would you agree that the two of you agree on a national bill of rights? Well, of course, they didn't at all. Their positions were entirely different. And essentially, Lara was making Bush's case for him. And when Gore tried to lay out the details, he looked like he was some kind of niggler. You know, he's making little Dingle, Norwood, whatever it was. But here's Jim Lehrer ratifying the assumptions of the campaign in a national debate. It was like, it was supine, I thought. And I think that's fairly typical of the path that Bush got in this campaign.
Well, how about that, Frank Bruni? And we understand you were on the bus, but did the press succumb to a kind of lightness of being in covering George Bush?
Well, I'm a little bit confused by what Jack's saying, because I think if people read the New York Times, for example, and I'm not speaking of my coverage because I was primarily writing writing about his day-to-day activities on the campaign, but, you know, we ran any number of issues pieces. We ran record pieces on his record in Texas. I remember the paper running a very hard-hitting piece on Bush's record on health care in Texas. There were pieces on, you know, that mentioned time and again where Texas ranked in terms of child poverty and stuff like that. You know, we certainly pointed out the incredibly stark difference between Bush's and Gore's positions on Social Security. Bush, of course, wanted partial privatization. We pointed out the differences in their positions on prescription drugs. I mean, I don't doubt that Jim Lehrer served up a question that way, and it ratified, you know, any sort of attempt by the Bush campaign to make it sound like there weren't differences. But we wrote about the issue differences, and we wrote about Bush's record extensively.
And yet, in many parts of the country, it would look, I guess, over all of this, it would look as though American voters actually responded and positively to the very kind of demeanor of simplicity and simplification that Bush projected.
But that's where it comes back to where the media certainly can do things better. And there were a lot of, I mean, I would say we could have devoted even more, not just at the Times, everywhere, even more column inches to record and issues pieces, although all those pieces were there. I think there's an argument for running them in several ways more than once to make it really easy for readers to see them. And we certainly get a little bit too involved in writing about political strategy and the kind of political food fights between candidates. But there's a point at which you can't make people engage. You can't make voters beyond those who are regular consumers of newspapers, et cetera, engage more deeply than they do. And for a lot of voters, what they saw or what they, you know, what got across their radar regarding George W. Bush or regarding Al Gore, you know, in a different way, they looked up, they saw George W. Bush posing with, you know, black people surrounding him at campaign events. They were treated to a whole lot of semiotics and symbolic stuff that told them George W. Bush was a new generation kind of Republican. And if that stuff had an effect on them, it was because they were only engaging on the most superficial level. And I don't know how the media can answer that or what we can do about that.
Well, and yet, as you say, there were fundamental things about the man that the public was responding positively to. You say he was a sentimental patriot, a man exhilarated and emboldened in the most guileless of fashions by the idea that he was claiming a place in history. Frank Bruni describes George W. Bush as someone who held on to wonder and a profound sense of responsibility, and then would come out with terrific bloopers like he wanted to help Americans to in their struggle to put food on your family. Well,
right.
That's our president, the wonder and the wonderment all wrapped up in one. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Elliot is on the line. Welcome, Elliot. You're on the air.
Hi, it's good to speak with you.
Good to have you.
I have to take exception to one thing Mr. Bruni is repeating, which is that it's the disengagement of the electorate that let a simple-minded man slip through. I agree that his record and his bloopers were all out there for everyone to see. And throughout the campaign, mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time fuming about how amazed I was that people couldn't see it. But I finally realized they do see it.
Mm-hmm.
Bush is tapping into, I think, a profound anti-intellectual trend. And people understood that he's a simple man and were actually relieved that he wasn't smarter than them, that he wasn't smarter than the other politicians, especially as a reaction to the prior administration.
Elliot, I think you're so right on there. Let's put that to Frank Bruni. What do you think, Frank? Is it the case, perhaps, that George Bush's evident failings and fumblings just made him seem human in a way that people wanted their leader to be human just now?
Oh, sure. I would take exception, though. It's Elliot that just called,
mm-hmm.
right? I would take exception at me saying they let a simple-minded man slip through. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I would describe George W. Bush as simple-minded. I think it's more complicated than that. He's certainly ineloquent, and he's not intellectually curious, but he's also not dumb. But yes, I remember writing at the time, and I write extensively in my book about Bush taking pains, which was easy in his case because he's not an intellectually oriented guy, but taking pains to seem like the anti-intellectual because of that strain in American life that likes someone who has kind of a more populist flavor and a less elite flavor.
You say he was defiantly proud of his own failings and foibles.
Exactly. I mean, when it came to sort of information stuff, and I mean, he would deliberately, you know, say things like, you know, oh, shoot, if I go back up to the front of the plane, they're going to want me to read one of those policy books, and I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
it's very rare that a politician forgets himself or herself around reporters. So he knew what he was saying to us, and he knew what he was signaling to the American people, and he knew, as Elliot rightly says, that in many ways more voters would rather have someone who seems kind of like them than someone who seems to be coming from a much loftier intellectual plane.
And yet, wasn't that just a kind of con? I mean, he's the scion of wealth and privilege. If his name were not George Bush, as someone said to Edward Kennedy years ago, he would not be president. And the sort of nonchalance that he exhibited in the campaign can be seen as simplicity, or just a simple heart, man just going about his business, or as a kind of overweening arrogance, basically saying, I am breaking out of the campaign finance deal. I'm going to spend more money than anyone's ever spent to be president, and my name is George W. Bush, and I'm just going to wait on these laurels, and they're going to elect me. I mean, that's not populism. That's sort of, well, elitism.
Well, but Frank, how about that? Could it be on the other side that in his many years in Midland, Texas, George Bush really did develop an affinity for that unelite side of American life?
Oh, I think he did. I think it's an important part of his self-image. It does. I mean, a lot of things are true at once. I mean, his pedigree is what it is. But a lot of the way he behaves in the anti-intellectual folksy sense is his own personal rebellion against that pedigree. It is consistent with what he wants to believe about himself. It's consistent with the way he wants to be seen. And that can all be true without erasing his background and the enormous advantages it bequeathed. Mm-hmm. You know, for him not to want to behave like the product of that background in too overt a way doesn't erase it, but it also doesn't make it less genuine than that's the way that's the way he would like to see himself. Mm-hmm.
Brian's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Brian. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a little upset by the attitude that Mr. Bush is somehow inadequate or usurped this position that he has. He has demonstrated over the entire dilemma that we've gone through since September 11th, mm-hmm, that he is more than qualified, mm-hmm, to lead this country. I always hear these people talking about his lack of demeanor when he's in front of the microphone and things like that. I think we had 8 years of a glib,
a very smooth, silver-tongued president.
Boy, did we ever.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have a man who represents himself with emotion and with compassion and really represents what we all feel. Why is it so hard for people to accept that this man feels the same that we do and is yet not qualified to lead the country in the direction that it needs to go?
Brian, there's a voice speaking right to it. Let me put it to Frank Burney. Frank, you write that here was a man whose Republican supporters and even a few of his advisors had worried could seem small and insubstantial. He projected affability more easily than authority, levity more readily than gravity. He favored informal banter over formal oratory. All of this had made him an unusual candidate for the presidency in the first place. Would you say that post 9/11 those kind of attributes have been laid to rest? Or is this always going to be a man who's more casual in his approach to the presidency, but as our caller Brian says, feels just right anyway to a lot of people?
I think he'll always be a little bit more casual in manner because that's who he is. I have never suggested anything I've said tonight on the program or anything in the book that he is inadequate as a president. In fact, I'm the one who said I don't think he's a simple-minded man. You know, there are certain things about him that are true that some people do connect with. This kind of goes back to one of the reasons his campaign was as successful as it was. Granted, the election kind of ended in a tie. But there are many people, like the caller who just called in, who find an authenticity and sincerity in him that to them matters much more. And maybe should matter much more than a kind of raw, you know, formal eloquence.
Mm-hmm. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Just fine, thanks.
I have a question. It's a critical question. On January 29th, CNN reported that George Bush had asked Tom Daschle to limit the scope of the investigations into the 9/11 disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the New York Times and the Washington Post have spent the last few years supporting the continual expenditure of funds on the Clinton affair, Lewinsky, Whitewater, etc. Why is it that we're talking about George Bush's adequacy and whether he has any kind of oratorical ability when the greatest crisis of my lifetime is something that he doesn't want to talk about as an oil man, while European journalists are making credible arguments that as an oil man with UNICAL, there may have been involvement on the part of his administration in the Afghanistan situation prior to 9/11. Why isn't the New York Times putting any effort to explain to me why he doesn't want it investigated?
John, you're painting a large conspiracy with a few words, and I don't know if we can speak to the details, but Frank Bruni, what about it? Is there a Teflon factor with George Bush when it comes to the press, either through his administration's resistance to revealing detail or to his own kind of bluff demeanor that says, oh, let's not be bothered with all that little stuff?
I certainly don't think the press is cowed or dissuaded by his bluff demeanor or what you describe as his bluff demeanor. I do think that there's a kind of adjustment that needs to be made and is being made where immediately after September 11th, and I'm not talking to the caller, specific question because I couldn't follow all that, to be honest with you, but there has been, in the wake of September 11th, there was a media reluctance, I think understandable if not ideal, to be too overly critical of what was going on, it was the same impulse, I believe, that has led to the 80% and 90% approval ratings for George W. Bush, which isn't an indication that that percentage of Americans would vote for him, but it was all part of people feeling like the right thing to do is to rally around and not undercut a leader. I think that pendulum is swinging back. I know in my own paper, I've been reading a whole lot about the paucity of information coming out of this administration. We've got reporters who've been writing day in and day out about the unanswered questions in relation to the Cheney Energy report and who contributed to it. So I think there was a kind of pause in critical coverage, a kind of diminution of it after September 11th. But I think we're kind of getting adjusted back to the right place.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Is this the honeymoon and then the war terror shock, or is George W. Bush, has he been cut some extra slack for some reason having to do with his demeanor?
I don't know about the demeanor. I just think the shock and the intimacy of this wound, first time the homeland had been attacked and so on, I just think that would cut any president all kinds of slack. But to John's point, it is the fact that the FBI director, the Justice Department, the Attorney General, and the CIA director, all of whom were on the watch on September 10th, are still in office. And they're still presumably investigating their own failures. After Pearl Harbor, within months, there was an inquest. People were fired. People were moved around. I'm not saying let's get heads on the pike, but the fact is, the Bush administration has a vested interest, a political interest, in not letting investigations go too far, lest we, begin to question the caliber of the people he's got in office.
We're talking tonight with Frank Bruni. He's author of Ambling Into History. We're getting an intimate look at President George W. Bush, the rascal on the campaign trail, and what he's brought to the White House. What do you think? Where are this president's instincts taking the country now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How is this amiable president intersecting with history? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about President George W. Bush, the character of the man, and the imprint that character is leaving, is likely to ultimately leave, on the American nation, a man elected in a time of innocence and prosperity, and soon after thrust into a time of unprecedented challenge. Our guest tonight is New York Times correspondent Frank Bruni, author of Ambling into History, The Unlikely Odyssey of George W. Bush. You can join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. How is this amiable president intersecting with history? And is the very simplicity of the Bush line a source of strength for the country now or something else? Join us. Eno is on the line. Welcome, Eno. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
I'm calling from Madison, Massachusetts. Thank you for your show. It's a great show.
Thank you.
But I have a comment. Looking at the electorate, the American electorate, it gives me the impression that we usually don't put much emphasis on the intellectual superiority of the person we're electing to the office of presidency. And looking at, you know, the choice of current president we have. And
so what do you think Americans do look to or value in that choice, Eno?
Well, it seems that there are more emphasis to the eloquence of the person in terms of someone who can mobilize an activist and maybe family background and the dollar amount that the person can bring, with him to gain office. But we don't really put much on the aspect of, okay, how can this leader pair up with other leaders, with other head of state? How can that person deliver a message, with eloquent and in a very academic or intellectual way?
You know, I want to take away from that, and thank you for your call. I want to take away this point about intellect. Of course, there's a very old and venerable anti-intellectual streak in American politics and culture. But Frank Bruni, speak directly to this issue of intellect and George W. Bush. Have you ended up seeing him as handicapped in this regard or as plenty well-armed on the intellectual side when he goes into a serious, nuanced policy discussion? Do you feel confident that he's coming out understanding it top to bottom?
Well, those are kind of two different questions. I mean, so let me take them separately. I mean, is he bright? Yes, he's very bright. And I think we're all being a little shallow when we intersperse the words intellectual and or when we conflate the words intellectual and intelligent, because they're not the same thing. And, you know, I remember so many times I would have conversations with, very ardent Democrats who would say, well, Gore's clearly much smarter than Bush. And I'd say, what do you mean by that? And it turned out they were judging that by the fluidity of the words that came out of his mouth, the amount of information he kept at his disposal. I'm not sure those are the only yardsticks for being smart.
Absolutely. And I'm really asking you to look right past that. The two do meet at the word intellect and the weight of intellect. And right there, you're saying you don't have any concern on that front.
I don't have any concerns about Bush having an ample intellect. You then asked, would I have any concerns about him going into an extremely nuanced policy meeting and being able to participate in that discussion at a very detailed and intricate level? That's a different question, and there one might have some reservations because George W. Bush has always been an executive summary guy, not a detail guy. He's someone who doesn't wade deep into the details of things. Some people, a lot of CEOs, a lot of business school types will tell you that's his great strength. But no, I don't see him sitting in these meetings and saying, well, but, you know, one of the subtle implications of what you just said, you know, strikes to what's on page 22. No, that's not George W. Bush. I'll leave it to voters to decide whether that's a problem or not.
He brings a kind of populist intelligence and determination. You write about his idiosyncratic ways of looking at and filtering the world. You say, when he told Senator Chuck Schumer, a New York Democrat, of his concern about the country staying patient with a sustained war against terrorism, the point of reference he used had to do with professional sports, namely his beloved baseball. And then you say, Bush said he didn't want Americans to, quote, lose interest when the World Series rolls around. Now, that's fascinating. On the one hand, that's an extremely it's a sports metaphor. It's as populist as you can get. On the other hand, he seems to be describing what we see rolling out here, which is a determination to go all the way with this war on terror. And what the World Series is, we don't even know yet. Does that mean war with Iraq or something even bigger? These metaphors do give him a kind of strength of vision, whether you agree with it or not, don't they?
Well, the World Series reference was actually to the actual World Series last year. What he meant was, I can't remember when the World Series was played, but that he was worried about people losing interest so quickly that by the time baseball played its World Series, they would already have diminished interest in the.
Oh my gosh! So I've put a metaphor in the president's mind. It doesn't.
You
even
made
fit
it
there.
A little bigger. Yeah.
Sorry,
no. My
sorry
point
friend.
Was his. My point was he sometimes has such a peculiar and narrow frame of reference and field of interest, you know, mm-hmm. which is very clear. You know, I talk about all the pop culture things that escaped his notice, not because those are intrinsically important, but he has a very kind of narrow field of interest that influences the way he talks and thinks about a great deal of things. And so he's constantly using athletic metaphors because he doesn't have that many other metaphors available to him.
Got
he
it.
Also said in a private meeting that he didn't want the terrorists stealing home on him, you know, another baseball metaphor.
Yeah, and forget my question on that one. I was definitely a bridge too far. Michael is on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, as far as his stamp on history, mm-hmm. His incuriosity, evidently, makes me really concerned, especially given what a conservative religious bent he has. He seems to believe that this God fellow kept him from being a pathetic drunk, and I don't think he really... I don't think he really understands people who don't believe as he does, and the fact that for example, some of the things that people worry about with regard to Ashcroft, I don't think he really can understand that.
Mm-hmm. Michael, thanks for your call. Frank Bruni, what about it, the depth, the sincerity, the impact of President Bush's religiosity?
Michael's right. He's deeply religious, and he when he speaks about his experience through life and becoming more religious, it's almost in the tone, cadence, diction of a born-again Christian. I do think that he, if anything, soft pedals how religious he is in public because I think his advisors and he understands that there are people like Michael who are a little taken aback by it, a little unnerved by it, and I understand that. And so it's something to keep an eye on, but I would also say there is within Bush and in kind of counterbalance to that deep Christian religious streak. There's also the New England WASP who believes that government time is best spent not on thorny and controversial social issues per se, or those kinds of, you know, social issues, and better spent on other matters. So it is a little bit of it kind of leavens that in him that he has that contrary kind of northeastern WASP impulse.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, where do you see the president's spiritual side coming out, maybe post 9/11?
Well, I just wish that he lived up to what he said when asked who his favorite or most important political philosopher was. He said it was Jesus Christ. Well, I don't know that Jesus Christ would have an economic program quite like his. But to get to this issue of God, one of the things that struck me, Frank, in your book was Bush thinks that God has called him to this moment, to September 11th.
Frank Bruni, yeah, divine calling?
He has said to friends, and that's what I report in the book, he has said to friends variations on, so it's hard to know the exact language, but variations on God clearly intended me to do this with my life, intended me to be prosecuting this war, for lack of a better phrase. And it's unclear to me, because there's a game of telephone going on where people say it secondhand, whether what he's saying and what he's feeling, and maybe there's not much of a difference, is he wouldn't be in this job at this moment if God didn't think he was up to it, or if he's literally saying God chose me to do this. Either way, it is a degree of zealousness, for lack of a better word, that many people do find discomforting.
Frank, let's get one more call. Jana's on the line. Welcome, Jana. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point that President Bush, in my mind, is a dangerous president. I think his personality is sort of ill-fitted to the times.
In what way, Jana?
Well, after September 11th, even American Muslims who completely denounced terrorism were saying that we, from a foreign policy standpoint, mm-hmm. we had it coming, and that in the eyes of the rest of the world, we had it coming. And so I think, you know, for George Bush to have a sort of frat boy image and the telltale smirk that he often has, and to get on TV and to give his Axis of Evil speech, it's just, It comes across as dumb American hubris.
Gina, thanks. I'm going to have to cut it there because our time's running down. But let me put that to you, Frank Bruni. Here's a man known for his stubbornness. He had an enforcer reputation in his father's presidential campaign. He's got this feisty Texas-style resolve. What about Gina's concern that this translates into an image of a president not nuanced, not listening, maybe too seen as brutal abroad?
Well, I mean, there are people who will tell you, and I don't want to be the final judge of this, that to speak in the kind of forceful language he did when he talked about the axis of evil, that that's the kind of language that the audience that he's speaking to understands better than anything else. I don't have an opinion on that. I'm not sure what I think about that, but it may be. I mean, we just have to wait and see. This is all a work in progress, and it's hard to know whether that kind of language is going to absolutely backfire. I think it certainly struck some of our allies as strange, and we have to worry about that as well. But there are people who will tell you that's the kind of language you need to use to fulfill the objectives he has. I just don't know.
Our time's running down. Frank Bruni covered President Bush's presidential campaign for the New York Times. He's a writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. His new book is Ambling Into History, The Unlikely Odyssey of George W. Bush. Frank Bruni, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Jack Beatty, we just begun to scratch this, and I guess the real story of George W. Bush will be told in the facts of his presidency.
Yeah, what's that Shakespeare line? Some men are born to greatness, some have greatness thrust upon them. Well, it's his hour to measure up to the challenge, and we'll just have to see, as you say, a work in progress.
And how fascinating we've seen from Joe Klein just last week talking about President Bill Clinton never getting that supreme challenge that brought him completely into himself in the presidency.
And how that must eat away at him and his retirement. Gosh.
Especially now. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can read the first chapter of Frank Bruni's Ambling Into History at our website. The address is onpointradio.org. In a moment, a radio diary from a 17-year-old girl about how the anger in the Middle East is resonating with her life as a Latina in the United States. Diary from Gabriela Jacobo. She's 17 years old, watching the news from her home in California. She says she's been surprised to feel as though she can relate to, or at least understand, a bit of the desperation felt by some of the Palestinian girls she's heard about who have chosen death. Her unique perspective comes to us from Youth Radio.
Lately, I've been following what's happening in the Middle East a lot. I've always heard about male suicide bombers, and that hasn't shocked me. But when I started reading the stories of suicide bombers who are girls close to my age, I was surprised. I tried to imagine what they were thinking. I know it's strange, but in some ways it's not hard for me to relate to the Palestinian female suicide bombers. I will never understand why they destroyed others, but I do know what it feels like to want to destroy yourself. Maybe they felt a little bit like I do, as a Latin American female. I've grown up feeling almost like I am not a real person, feeling ignored. In that way, I think my life is similar to the lives of the Palestinian women. They live in a culture that almost makes them invisible. And when you feel like people can't see you, it's hard to feel like you are even alive. Being a part of a suicide bombing makes the bomber a martyr and lets them be included in something bigger than themselves. In death, they became visible. They became what they weren't in life. When I was a child, I was afraid of death. But I understand that in some ways, dying can be easy. If life feels unbearably hard, death can seem like the simplest way out. But there is a huge difference between feeling powerless and wanting to die and actually strapping explosives to your body and killing others. I will never understand why someone would cross that line, but then I have alternatives where others may not.
Gabriela Jacobo lives in Richmond, California. Her diary came to us courtesy of Youth Radio. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, George Hicks, Darren Manoogian, Tim Monroe, Tim Skog, and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is...